Blog Talk Radio.
Talk. It's our new format. Actually, we cut the show down to 90 minutes. It was a time for years we're doing the show. We're doing it for 2 hours, but we kind of ditch things down a little bit and a little less talking. If you ask me, I'm your host, Mark Elliott, soon to be joined by Mr. DeMaurice and Mr. Charles. But let me give you a little idea what we kind of do over here in a sense. We get together once a week, and it's our forum to share our dialogue on love, relationship, and different factors of life. Most of the time, we're shooting for an honest self-evaluation, and give us a chance to kind of share our views openly. But I always say this, I love the fact that we don't shy away from some things need to be said. So we're always trying to find different topics to steer a conversation, and I'd like to give these gentlemen some things to think about. Tonight will be no different. We're going to find some things to kind of just chop up a little bit and think about some things. With that being said, let me bring in the gentleman that's in Illinois that... May not be too happy today, but that's okay. Mr. DeMaurice, how you feeling, sir?
Trying to stay sucker free in a world full of lollipops, man. That's all I got to say right now.
I believe that one right there, my brother. I kind of got a feeling what you're talking about, but sometimes things are better off left just right where they are, my brother. You know, you and I are not too far in age. We're kind of close in age, and we kind of see things, you know, from a different time span, the way we grew up and the way things are now. But it seems to me back in the past, men was more thought of to be more logical thinkers, and we felt logical. But something I noticed over the years, I'm not going to call it a trend, it just seemed like things have kind of changed in a sense. It seemed like a lot of men now are reacting and thinking with their emotions first, as opposed to maybe kicking back and thinking logically. Am I on to something in thinking this?
I think you are. It's a sign of the times. And as a society, when we're exposed to a lot more things, I think that the old way of thinking, or in our generation, or the generation before us, or the generation before them, their way of thinking tends to be thought of as old-fashioned or out of touch sometimes. But I tend to find myself holding on to a lot of the things that the men before me, the generation before me, thought about and valued. And I tend to kind of reinforce my manhood and things in that, instead of kind of following what society is saying now.
You brought up something I want to go back to in a little bit, but I want to get Mr. Charles in. You brought up old-fashioned, and that's a key word right there, my brother, old-fashioned. And that's the word that's kind of thrown out. And another time we hear not old-fashioned, old-school, kind of like the same thing in a sense. We're speaking on, you know, back in the day, I guess when we were younger, men tend to were more logical thinkers. But it seemed like as of late that we find that as men, some of us are thinking with our emotions and acting out on our emotions first without actually sitting back and thinking clearly. Your response and your thoughts to that. And welcome to the show, bro.
Thank you. Appreciate it. How y'all doing this evening?
I'm always good, man. I can't speak for Mr. DeMaurice, man. I'm always good.
No, you sure can't. I'm good too.
All right, well, you know, I got to check on you because I really don't know him, so I got to check on you. You know what I'm saying? I'm still getting to know him. You know how we go. Anyway, but no, the answer to the question, I agree with that from the standpoint of we still do have some people that are quick to pull the trigger, but as you get older, you understand that. For me anyway, not to let certain things bother me and not to give my control away. So I learned that from my dad, because my dad really didn't. He was truly old school. You had to do a lot to get my father engaged. But once he did, you might want to go hide somewhere, because he will pull his pistol out wherever he had to do to handle the situation. So you didn't want him to engage. So as I got older, I started to really understand that too. So, because I think what we need to teach our younger men is that you have so much power, and DeMaurice can really speak to this. He will not. But I know he's probably full of he got a lot of rage. You know, nobody want to talk about that. But he uses his mind and so many other things to release, and I love that in him, particularly with his book. I love that, and that's why he kind of suckered me into writing that forward, and I did it because he got me all emotional. But that's the thing that we have to pass on to our younger men, to use your brain, and you can still get the satisfaction that you're looking for instead of balling up your fist and knocking somebody out.
As you said earlier, Mr. Reeves, you spoke of old-fashioned, and it's interesting because, you know, I understand, because when we came up to, let's kind of be real, we looked at some things our parents was instilling and was doing. It's like, you know, that's old, and we wanted the new wave stuff. And the older we became, we realized the closer you stayed to the older fashion or old fashion, the better you were. And it's interesting because times may change, things may look different, but some of the same old-fashioned thoughts and rules, man, will still apply and work well in today. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. And we believe that, you know, we got to put a spin on everything. We got to have everything be a little better. And you hear that sometimes, old-fashioned, you know, that's old-fashioned. And sometimes, you know, you hear that from folks and they're saying it, you see the path they're going, and the path doesn't look from your perception or my perception. I say, it doesn't look like it's correct. But they would constantly say to you, okay, you're old-fashioned and blah, blah, blah. Then things don't work out right. They stand and they have this puzzle look and they kind of wonder why. But I want to come back to you, Mr. Charles, with this in a sense, because I think this is a part of it that what I've seen with some younger cats, in a sense, that may cause them to kind of think first with their emotions and react with their emotions. And I know everybody's not going to like me saying this or kind of run to this tip, but I think it plays a part, and the part probably is crucial, in the sense that a lot of young males over the years and currently have been raised in homes without the father being there. And what they've seen and what they latched on to is the emotional reaction of their mother or the aunties or the grandmas. And they kind of picked up on that, not really knowing, and that's what they had. And they bring that into their manhood, and they responded to it in that way. So anytime something kind of basically, there's no in between, everything gets the same emotional all-out reaction, regardless what it might be. Now, that's just one of my perceptions of it, but I wanted to get your opinion on that, sir.
I can see that, and I agree with that. I think there are some instances where that's definitely the case, but I think that even when the dad's not there, if there's a strong male role model, it really helps, because there's something that we call as males or men, and we need to revert to African-American men, but maybe others too, but definitely African-American men. There's what we call rules to the game. And no matter what the situation is, if you understand, and we teach young men to understand what the situation is they're dealing with and what the rules are, what how things go, and what not only do the rules that they have to follow, but the power that they have inside this game. And that's where we mess up, because we don't teach them that. They get emotional because somebody says something to them. And not realizing that, you ain't got to worry about that. Because here's where you sit in this situation. And here's what you can do. You don't have to always be emotional, because you understand the long-term situation instead of the short-term.
I was fortunate, of course, to have my father and be raised by my father. And I've gotten plenty of toughness from my father by kind of just watching as a little boy. But in a sense of being told how to be tough and pushed to be tough, ironically, it came from my mother. And my mother always kind of, you know, made it clear, like, you know, you got to be tough about this. This, you got to, and may not have said it in those ways, but her actions. It's like, you don't have time to be worried about that. If you can't change it, you can't fix it. Those type of things that were kind of always instilled formed a sense of toughness. Coming to you, Mr. DeMaurice, like I gave the question to Mr. Charles about maybe the lack of a black model there, in a lot of cases, or some cases, kind of plays into the transition of young men and men responding to things with their emotions and not looking at it logically first sometimes.
Yeah, I can agree with that also. And sometimes these same young men aren't really exposed to men in the different arenas that they're in, whether it's church, whether it's in their social life, things of that sort. And I can see that going into adulthood. But I can remember growing up that not only your father was around, I'm speaking of my father, but you had uncles, you had cousins, you had friends, you had neighborhoods, you had a different men around you. You had your peers. And I do agree with what Mr. Charles said. You know, you learn the rules of the game, hanging around, not only hanging in with your family, but because usually your cousins are like your first friends. And so I was fortunate to grow up with a lot of older cousins my age. It was a thing, and I know our family, it was like toughening you up. So you couldn't walk around like a punk or operate as a punk in my family, because the older cats in my family would always, I know 5 minutes into seeing them and saying hello, you in the back room or in the backyard scrapping. So that wasn't allowed. That just wasn't allowed. And it didn't seem like the women in the family or anywhere around. It was just the way it was. And you couldn't go running back and telling them, you know, the so-and-so did this. You just got to a point where you just had to fight your way out of it or scrap. You knew what was coming. So nowadays, that's not the case. I know sometimes when I'm around my younger nephews, there's certain siblings who know that, you know, that's the rule, but other siblings like, oh no, don't bother them, don't do that. And it's like, okay, you're teaching them to be punks. And so I don't know why that is today. It could be that, it could be a number of reasons, but in our day, and I explained that to a group I was talking to not too long ago, that, you know, when you came to a new neighborhood, you had to fight. No, none. Hey, how you doing? Let's go play with our toys, or let's go play football. You had to fight to earn your rank in the neighborhood, and they were shaking their head like, "Oh, that's not how it's done right now." And so you see a decline. And I do think that sometimes what happens is, I know that the older generation didn't do everything right. So what I kind of did is say, "Okay, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to handle it another way." And I think that too is as a way that we get away from the original rules or the original old school way of doing it, because we kind of looked at our lives and looked at their lives and go, okay, maybe certain things didn't work. So maybe try something else or open my mind to something else. And maybe it just got awry when folks kind of turned against that particular style of doing things, or saying, oh, that's too old school, that's too old fashioned for me. And maybe folks kind of looked into other ways of doing it. But, I know you remember some of those, you know, the uncles and older folks in the neighborhood. You could not walk around being a punk in those neighborhoods.
Yeah, it's funny, man, because while you was talking, I thought of how in grammar school, you would just get tested for no reason. You would just get tested for no reason. You couldn't. I remember years ago, and this, of course, this goes back way years ago, that my mother brought me some Jeepers, bro. You know what Jeepers were back then. They weren't Converse.
Oh, yes.
They weren't nothing special. But to me, they were shiny. They were good. And I don't think I was in school for half an hour, but somebody walked up and stepped on my left foot purposely. Just stepped on it. Bang! It's like, what are you going to do at this point? What are you doing?
Everybody looking too.
Exactly. Everybody paying attention. What are you going to do? because you're thinking, yeah, okay, I don't want to get in trouble, but at the same time, I got to react. I got to do something, and it was on at that point. And like you said, it's different in a sense, and I'm not promoting that way because it was foolish back then. It'll be foolish now, but if you kick butt back then, you'd have to kick anybody else's butt. It's just how it was. If you handle your business with one and handle it well, the word got out, and you just you walked around school like you owned the campus because they just didn't bother you. So from that one stomping on the sneaker, being taking care of that correctly, it just opened up other doors just to where somehow, you know, respect came. I was going to ask you more about the old school, but you really touched on it, so it's no need to go there in a sense. But I think sometimes the old school, how we might have ran away from it, because sometimes when we were coming up, the old school seemed like it was so prohibitive. Like, we couldn't do this. We couldn't do such. We couldn't do anything. So as soon as you probably got a little independence, you just broke loose. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not doing this. I'm not, you know, you was trying your best to really detach yourself from what was really being given to you or the parameters that are set around your life. And sometimes it takes a while, again, to get out there and realize that those parameters in that old school, in that old fashion, was really set in place to have you flourish as you aged as a man or a woman in that sense. Tell me, something I want to, I don't think we ever talked, well, we might have talked about this, but I don't think we went this, as deep when we go this evening, but being broke is something I want to talk about, because it seems like to me, you know, whenever you have a surplus of money, things just happen to kind of want to take away and eat at that surplus. It's almost like the Pac-Man thing. If you got a surplus, it comes a big mouth or something that just needs to happen. You know, your headlight go out. This may happen. Different things just happen when you seem like you have a surplus hanging around. Now, what I want to really kind of find out and kind of get to in this conversation is, even when we have a surplus, there's a level of fear of being broke and not having enough just to cover and getting back to that situation where funds are short. So I'll come to you first on this, Mr. DeMaurice. Why is it that we walk around with the fear of actually being broke?
Because you don't want to be broke, man. You always want to have some, you always want to have some money in your pocket. Because I notice when I do have a surplus, I have a whole another attitude about myself, what I could do. You know, you feel confident. You know, you could do it whatever you want, so to speak. But when you're broke, it's like it limits you. It kind of messes with you because it seems like everybody's after you, the bill collector's after you, and you know you don't have it up until a certain time. So yeah, it's like you don't want to be broke. But I know as I walk on my journey, man, I realize that. All throughout my life, you know, you've been broke. You know, you have money, and you got to treat them both the same. You can't, you know, kind of ride the roller coaster of having a lot and then having a little. And then it helps you kind of prepare and be a better steward of your money. Because it's a crazy story. Not a crazy story, but I remember meeting this pastor. I was working out of this center. And this pastor owned the center that we were doing a research project out of. And every Friday, the guys that showed up at his group, he had a group of men, about 30 men that showed up in the group. He always gave them $10. He always gave them $10 on a Friday. Now, they met every day out of the week, but on Fridays, he gave them $10. And I asked him one day, I was like, why'd you give them $10? He said, well, a man feels better when he got some money in his pocket. He said, a man always feels better when he has some money in his pocket. He said, we live in a society where men feel better, you know, get them, you know, a soda pop or, you know, get them something. Or if a child wants some candy, they can provide for him. He said, I know some of these men don't come in here with money. So I want to provide them with a little sense of pride, or especially on Friday when most people are getting paid. Some of these guys aren't getting paid or don't know where their check is coming from. I want them to have a little bit of money where they can go get them a cheeseburger or something, so they don't feel bad walking around in the street trying to make it and trying to make ends meet. And so I thought about that, and I thought about my own personal life. Like, who wants to be broke, man? Who wants to be broke? And I know as a man, you know, you always want to have something in your pocket. Think about the older guy, cats that we grew up with. You saw them, uncle, granddad. Granddad used to just give you a quarter as a kid, just to have something to go to the store. And it always made you feel like you weren't left out, that you can, if your friends were going to the store, you can go to the store, get you something to eat, or get you some candy, or get you a bag of potato chips. It cost like 10 cents, 15 cents back then. And so as men, you always want to feel good about yourself. And so being broke means that you're out of the game. You can't spend no money on no date or no woman, because she don't want to be with no broke, as Kanye would say.
Oh.
You know, Ray Charles, he sampled Ray Charles. You know, she give me money when I'm in need. You know, as men, you grow up like, you got to have some scratch in your pocket. You got to have some scratch in the pocket. And it could be a negative or positive, but it is tied into your self-esteem. It really is.
Yeah, that's where I was going, man. You got there before me, because it really does, as for a man, it is ties into your self worth, man. When you just basically you're low, your funds are low. It's strange how it comes there, but like you said, in life you're gonna have those ebb and flows where it happens, where you have surplus and sometimes you're low. And usually your lowness to me is a chance to kind of reevaluate some things and kind of see things a little different. But it does, it can plays with a man's self worth. And it's sad that it does, because a lot of us, when we have surplus, we think our self-worth is better than it actually is. Our head gets a little too big. So, Mr. Charles, I'm going to come to you. Is that one of our things that we fear? We ain't even talk about much, man. But we fear, man, not having any funds in the pocket. Why is that such?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, if you ever know what it's like to be broke, then you know, that reminder is like, oh my God, I don't ever want to be in that position ever again. And you just don't want to do that, because that means that forces you to hustle. And you might have to think quick on your feet. When you have money, you can relax, right? Because, you know, next Friday or two Fridays, your check is coming, or you're going direct deposit. You don't worry about it. Your $29,200 is going to be in there every 2 weeks, right? You ain't got to worry about it. It's already paid for. It's taken care of. You just spend money. You just keep moving forward. But when your money is low and you don't have that money coming in, you got to get creative. You got to get creative with your bills. You talking about women. Hell, you trying to worry about taking care of you first. The last he had to worry about that woman on the back end, because most women don't want to be dealing with a broke guy. We know that. So you got to get yourself together first. But I think that the experience of not having before and knowing what that's like is tough. So nobody wants to be broke. But I think when you are broke, then we find out what you're made of, truthfully. You know, I think about it from the standpoint of if your situation, if you've been, I guess I'll say this, if you have been what I call a fat cat, where you've been relaxing, you've been good, and nothing wrong with it, you've been, your job has been stable for years, and you've been doing it, you could do it 20 plus years sometimes. And then you get broke, and it's like, oh, hell no. Now what? But then you have to reevaluate that and go, now you got to get back on your hustle game. Maybe things you did when you were younger, or just the mindset. You got to be aggressive, and you got to make it. Because some people will help you, but a lot of people won't. So you got to get back onto what you were. And sometimes that's hard for people, because you've been a fat cat for 20 years, chilling, got your medical, everything, get your teeth clean you want to, you have a procedure, a surgery, car transmission go out, you just go to the bank. You just go, I don't want to do it, but you know what? Hey, you know, it is what it is. You ain't worried about it, but get broke. Find a way to be broke. You be like, damn, I can't ask them, I can't do this. I need my car. You have to make some decisions. Am I going to catch the bus? It's a lot going on in there. But, again, that's where the hustler in you comes out, if there is one in you. And, Lord, for sure, I would say, Lord, have mercy. I hope there is a hustler in you, because otherwise it can be devastating.
There have been men that taken their lives when brokenness have come to them and just really couldn't handle it. Just couldn't see tomorrow and just think that this is it. You know, they experience it. And I think, like I said earlier, I think there's some things you can learn. And you don't want to be broke on purpose. But I want to have us pull a lot of time out of our life where, you know, funds were low, how we went into it and how we kind of came out of it mentally, in a sense. But it was one time years ago, a few years ago. And you both know that, you know, I'm into photography. But it was a while ago that, here again, the surplus of this, some things happened, and had to move into a spot, and money was needed for that, and things were just hitting. And the camera that I purchased a while ago, the rest of the camera was, I forgot what I paid for it, but close to about $1,000 I spent for it, $1,000 probably. So things, when it got real tight and before payday was coming, you know, there was no funds left over. There was just nothing left there. And you say to yourself, how are you working and you have no funds left? It wasn't like, you know, I'll say throughout my years of working, there's been times I worked because I wanted to work. And there's been times I didn't work because I just didn't want to work. I'm thankful that I had those moments where, you know, if I didn't feel like working, it was a week or two, the ball wasn't gone. it just wasn't gone. But this was one of those times. It just wasn't one of those times. But anyway, I looked at the camera, and I said, you know what? I got to go pawn this. And when I went to the pawn shop, you know how they're going to try to take advantage of you. He was only willing to give, here again, the camera was $1,000. He was only willing to give $150. So here lies $150 between me and payday. And that's talking, you know, for 2 weeks, 14 days, we're talking food, gas, we're talking $150. And at first thought, it's like, how the heck am I going to take this and stretch this for 2 weeks? Something's bound to happen. That's going to probably pop up. It's going to be more than $150. And in my mind, man, I said, hey, God, I know you're going to make it work for me. I just know that you will, you know, you always say you never give me more than what I could bear. You're going to make it work. And in reality, you know, it did work. And it's funny, shortly after, I started looking at how much I was kind of spending from paycheck to paycheck. Some of it that didn't need to be spent, and realized that if I could take that $150 and make that work for 2 weeks, what can I do when there's a surplus for 2 weeks? You know, that's what I kind of got out of it. And I'm not saying we get broke to learn lessons, but I think sometimes, here again, it's a chance to kick back and reevaluate, look at some things differently, and kind of move forward. But there's always going to be, you know, no matter what probably happened, I don't care how much money you make, there's going to be a time when you're going to hit with something. You're going to hit with something that's going to basically rock you financially. And it's sad for the ones that chose to take their lives, couldn't think, have faith enough to believe that the sun will come out at some point. Even if it doesn't come out tomorrow morning, it's not going to just keep raining. The sun will come up. What are you going to do when that sun comes up? How are you going to allow it to kind of beam on your face? So that's the thing I want to share. And I guess when I was speaking of time, it was hard, bro. That was hard. $150. I mean, I could tell you sometimes, I went out to the supermarket and maybe drop $100. I could do that right now if I kind of, you know, put this down and went to the supermarket. That's nothing big. So, Mr. Charles, speaking of a time that funds were extremely low, and when it came upon you, it kind of really had to shake you a little bit and find, like you said, a way to hustle and deal to kind of bring yourself through it to the next time you're going to pick up some money.
Yeah, there's been a few. I mean, it is what it is, but I think you live to deal with them better. One in particular is because I was younger, and I think that's where it's hardest. It was hardest for me because I was so used to having things provided to me by my dad. And when you have to do things on your own, it's like, well, why somebody, that question comes up, why doesn't someone help me? But, you know, my father, true to fashion, was like, ain't nobody coming for you. Right? It was particularly after my dad passed, and I had to pay for his funeral. And he was, the burial was no problem because he was a veteran. But the actual funeral was a problem. There was really not a lot of money. So the money that we had to go towards his funeral. And then it was just a hustle. I was in college, and nobody really had any money. So then it was the hustle game. So I had to go out and do what I had to do, selling cars, little cars, our cars, doing some other things I shouldn't have been doing. Came down to $200. And it was right before the funeral. And the lady at the funeral home says, don't worry about it. You going to pay me? But you're getting late. I was like, okay. I was like, that's so nice. She's like, oh, no, don't get it twisted. I need my $200. I'm like, all right, you're just going to do it in installments, and you're going to pay it when you pay it. So anyway, the way it went is I had a stepmother, and right before it was time, like the day before the wake, she came in, and she just showed up out of nowhere. I'm like, damn, you know, she knew he was dead. And the lady talked to her, and she says, well, what's left? And she says, $200. My stepmother said, oh, no problem, got you. And I'm like, okay. And I was like, cool. Then it dawned on me. Same day. I'm like, this is a long story, but I'm going to make it short. It dawned on me why she came that day and said she had it. Because she was getting a check, bro. She was still married to my dad, and she's about to get paid the rest of her life. So what was $200? So the way it went forward, I did all that work to put this down for this money, and she come riding on this chariot with $200. I'm like, what the hell was you at in my mind before when I was bust out here selling stuff, short of everything else in my life, and then all of a sudden the last $200, you ride up on the chariot? The devil is a liar.
Oh.
So, and the way it comes down as I get off of this, God is so good, as I get off of this, they said, well, the funeral's tomorrow, the week, we'll come pick you up. So, oh, yeah, I'll be ready. Okay, no problem. So, funeral, all right? Blah, 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 I'm good. All right. Man comes to the house. I come down in the car, and the man says, you ready? I said, yeah. He said, we're going to pick anybody else up? Nope. Let's go to the funeral. Let's go to the funeral. And she never came to the funeral. She never showed up, but she's still getting a check today. Anyway, get off of that. God is so good.
Whoa, okay. That's a story there, my brother. That's a story there.
You said you wanted black men talk, right? You tell me.
That's
I told you about
I was getting ready to say.
I thought you were going to tell me you wanted a story about me not being able to buy penny candy. If that's what you want, I can get out.
No, sir. No, sir. No, I love that, man. I love that. That right there, man. You know, and that's what we do here, ladies and gentlemen. We get together, and this is what we do. We find things, different things to talk about. And it's a variety of stuff, a variety of things that we kind of just pull out. And I love the fact that as men, we're not afraid to go back if necessary. And talk about a time that may not have been pleasing for us, but we're not afraid to approach it. You know, there's nothing macho about, you know, just, hey, open up and sharing and talking. That's what we do here at Black Men Talk. Mr. Charles, Mr. Reese, and myself, Mark Elliott, and we appreciate you giving us a listen. No, I love that, man, but I'm gonna say what you said about her, man, because in a future show, we're going to kind of go into it, because my grandfather on my father's side, think some of that as well. And I thought I brought it up. We go back and approach it too, because I think sometimes we stand back and we look at the men that came before us, and we might have seen some things they did that we kind of see differently. and how, what type of action and impact. And so based on the things that we did, just seeing what they have done. So yeah, that's something in common. So you know, that's good, bro, right there. But I'm, you know, another thing too, Mr. Charles and I was speaking one day this week when if we take our first break, we come back, I'm have us fill us in some things that we might be doing a little different here on the show sometime soon. But Mr. DeMarie, sorry I didn't get to you a little quicker, man, but I want to get to you, sir. And a time that the quarters and dimes are basically all you had, and you work your way through it, through the surplus.
Well, I want to touch on one thing Mr. Charles said, man. Nothing teaches you how to hustle when you're on more than when you're on the campus of an HBCU and you ain't got no money coming in. You get together with other few folks who are in the same situation and you make it happen. I mean, that is, you learn a lot of things in college, but that is one of the things you learn on an HBCU campus as a black, poor student, learning how to hustle. But I remember one year, it was a year that my father was getting remarried a few years ago. And I was supposed to be in a wedding, and that summer I was teaching, and I was making, you know, travel preparations and, you know, going to the wedding and being in the wedding as one of his best men and all that other stuff. And I don't know, to this day I don't know, and even my tax guy doesn't know. Remember when we ended one of the shows and I just said $750?
Yeah.
The IRS was all up in my and a brother, man, all that summer, to the point where they just went into my paycheck that summer and went into my bank account and just started snatching money out. And so it ruined all my plans to travel, to do a lot of things that summer. It ruined me paying bills. I had to go to my landlord and say, listen, this is the situation. He was cool about it. Because that's one thing that I know as a man, you hate to, you know, not want to pay your bills and live up to your responsibility. As a true man, you want to live up to your responsibility. So I had to, you know, talk to my creditors and talk to other folks. And those aren't easy conversations to have, and come up with the documents telling them what's happening. But it was a real tight situation. So the last person I had to talk to was my dad. And I did not want to have this conversation because he wanted me to really be there. And I'm like, listen, man, this is the situation. I don't want it to ruin your you know, your happy day and all this other stuff, but I can't go. I got to turn in the tux. I got to make do with what I have. And my father, knowing the hustler he has, he said, you know what? God helps the child that has his own. So I know you'll be able to handle this. I'm like, cool. And so I had to handle it all that summer. So I got with a tax guy, and he kept asking me, he's like, what's going on? He said, I've never seen. He said, do you own a corporation? I'm like, no. Do you own any property? No. He said, why are they after you like this? And I said, I don't know if somebody has a personal vendetta. I have no idea. And I remember we were sitting in the McDonald's. He was going over all my stuff and all the past documents and taxes and everything. He's like, you know what, bro? He said, you're gonna pay me for this, but we're gonna work this out. And he said, give me your paperwork. You know, I'll call you if I have any more information that I need to get. But we're gonna work this out. He said, because this is unfair, and I feel obligated that I need to help you out with this. He said, I don't know why they're coming after you, a brother, like this, but we're gonna work this out. And to this day, he's still my tax guy. And it was just a hard summer thinking that, you know. What did I do to deserve this? Trying to figure out how I'm going to eat, how I'm going to pay bills, how I'm going to keep the lights on, all this other stuff. And actually, I think it was happening while we were doing some of our shows. And I never talked to anybody outside about it and trying to get help and all that other stuff, because you got to be a hustler out here if you're a man and you're trying to stand on your own and being responsible. And I just took it that way. And then once I was out of it, I made sure that I never got in that situation again. But at first, when my dad told me, like, you know, God bless the child that had his own, I'm like, you know what? You ain't going to help me or nothing? That's all you got? But I understood what he meant by that. And he had been raising me like that all the while. He'd been raising me. A man stands on his own. And I'm pretty sure if he was a rich guy, he would say, hey, here's this. Come on down and do what you need to do. But at the time, I was like, you know, I was in college. I wasn't asking them for money because, Lord knows, my parents didn't have that money to send me to college. So, like I said, I started off with being at an HBCU. A lot of us are coming from situations where we couldn't ask nobody, a parent or somebody, to help us out. And what we did receive, I remember going through my closet not too long ago, throwing out stuff, packing stuff up, and I got a letter from my mom. And I remember her putting a $20 bill. That's all she had at the time. She's like, I'm proud of you. Keep working hard. I can't give you much, but here's what I'm going to give you. And it brought a tear to my eye, man, because she didn't have much, but she just thought of me that much to give me something that I can go get, you know, go to the union and one of those parties for $2 or $3 in the union or something, at, you know, on the weekend or something like that. So, but, you know, you learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about, I always felt like when you got in situations like that, you really find out who's down with you and who's not. And sometimes it's good to go through those situations to really find out who's down with you and who's not. And it's kind of, to me, sometimes when you go through that, the way I think of it, it's a purification process. It's something that you need to get out, and then you can start anew again. And that's the way I kind of looked at it as I ventured farther in this journey, that it's a purification process. It's something that you need to go through to kind of clear the slate, or to get things right, or get things the way they're supposed to be. But that was a tough summer. That was a tough summer. And then I got it straightened out before the fall, and everything has been going smooth as far as taxes ever since. But that's why I got on the $750, you know, $750. And this is a rich guy, but, you know, the folks coming after, you know, the ordinary or poor man. And I to this day, I still don't understand that. But, yeah, that's why I was pissed off about that, hearing that news last week about that. That they came after me and took much more and take much more every year than what some of these folks or privileged folks are being taken for. So it just boggles my mind. But it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about myself, about other people, society. It taught me a lot about handling my business. It taught me a lot about the hustler inside, as Mr. Charles said. And you live and you learn. You live and you learn.
That's it right there, man. I gotta say something, man. I got a profound new respect for your dad, though. Okay. I mean, he gave it to you. A little cold, but he gave it to you. That's cold. I'm gonna go do this marriage thing, and I'll get back to you. Anyway, we're Black Men Talk. This is the Reese, Mr. Charles, Mark Elliott. We're gonna take a little short break, and we come back. I'm gonna throw the question out that I said last week, and this one's kind of a doozy in a sense. It's that we stop and think about it. You know, why? Just wonder why were you born? That's the question. As I said earlier, Mr. Charles and I had a chance to speak a little bit this week, and we kind of went over some things that we might be doing in a future show. It's a good possibility to be doing in the future show. But Mr. Charles, what I want you to do first, if you don't mind, sir, is explain to me what you're doing and then how it may turn into what we might do here on When Black Men Talk.
Oh, no doubt. I don't know how sometimes God has amazing ways he does things. So through my journeys professionally, I was asked recently, probably been about a year ago, to serve as a board member for a nonprofit here. And the nonprofit basically, they provide new housing and suitable housing for elderly adults. And oftentimes, this particular group, they provide primarily in neighborhoods where it's primarily African American and other minorities. So this organization has been around for years, and the reason why I was connected with it, you'll love this, Dee Maurice. One of our fellow Wilberforce alumnus, one of our sisters, her mom was in charge of this organization for years. Mom passed away, and she took over. And with that, she came with a new board because everybody didn't know her, and she wanted to make sure she had people around there she felt good about. Anyway, joined the board, and then we started going to work, and they had built a brand-new facility shortly thereafter. And there's a group of men and women, of course, but there's a group of men that are there, and they don't have a lot of activities. You know, they play checkers, whatever, do some other things. But one of the things that was brought to their attention, because we were helping them with activities as a board as well, they wanted to have like a round table discussion or a support group just as men to talk. And the executive director asked me, did I know anything or whatever? And I said, well, I do a radio show with a couple of great guys, one of our other alumni brothers. And maybe it's something that we can talk about, or at least start the conversation. So the conversation goes, I told her about when black men talk. And she's like, well, that's perfect, because these are black men primarily, and they want to talk. I said, yeah, okay. How can we get that together? So anyway, I told her that I would come back to the group and talk about it, but the essence of what we're thinking out early on is just kind of building a foundation, okay? So it may not be directly on our show right away, but building a foundation where these men can come together and perhaps have some of the very similar conversations on subjects that we're talking about and we have been doing for years. I think this might open the door, if nothing else, just to put some people in a good place where they can release and talk and then also maybe share. And it might make a major difference in their lives because it's spirited. And we all know that we all need to be fed spiritually and mentally, and particularly around a group of people that we can trust, particularly with men of color, particularly African-American men. So that's how this is based off. It's still brand new. Mark and I talked about it, but I had to bring it to the table because I would hate for this opportunity to come up and we could do some great work, and then I just let it go by the wayside because I didn't say anything.
Yeah, I love the idea, man. I was saying to Mr. Charles that thing kind of, you know, start to work itself out. What I want to do is, have a gentleman on from time to time, and we give them a segment. And we just kind of, just hash out, man. We hash and do some talking. And kind of in the sense of, too, they have that wisdom. And we're going to kind of ask them how they feel about their wisdom that may not be recognized by the younger generation. It seems like now there's a disconnect with the younger generation. I spoke to earlier about the old-fashioned, where we don't tend to look at some of our older peers where they can be of value and can share knowledge and help us to make our path a lot smoother and easier to go through. You know, we want to just basically carve our own, but a lot of times, man, we overlook what's available to us. So that's what I'm thinking initially, is that we basically have to be the same gentleman, but from time to time, we have one of them come on, and we open the door, allow them come in, make them feel like home, let them chat, let them speak it up. So that's something that will be coming in the future. I love the idea of that because we, like Mr. Marie said, we all had uncles or whatever that was around that kind of said some things. And these cats now, man, they've lived and maybe seen some things and done some things that we haven't done. And it's exposure for them. And we know talking is therapeutic. And if anything else, man, for these cats that I like about the idea as well, they can start to feel that they're not forgotten about, that people want to hear what they have to say. And we know talking is therapeutic. It helps to release and to open up and to share. So we could do anything, to help these gentlemen feel better about themselves. I'm all for it. And that will be taking place at some time, hopefully real soon, right here when Black Men Talk. Getting back to the question that I put out there earlier, and why were you born? And I don't think, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about it because, you know, we have enough to do on a daily basis, and we're trying to basically probably get enough juice out of orange of life in general. But if I had to stop and think, I think we all were born for a purpose. Our mother and fathers got together over 50 years ago for a reason for us to be here, even probably unbeknown to them at the time. However, they came together to have us, you know, as kids. There was something planned for us before they even probably got together. And it puts us in a situation, okay, why are we here? And I think sometimes we need to ask ourselves that, because if it's a purpose, and I'm not saying you got to live your purpose every single day and at all times, but I think throughout your life you should find purposes and goals that just not based on you trying to achieve or trying to have, but doing something with the gift that has been bestowed to you and given to you while you're here. And I'll take this first before I can push it out, because I, you know, it's something that made me really start to think in a sense. And my thing is that I think the elements while we're here in a sense, of course, was to basically produce, help on to produce life. In a sense, I have three kids, to make sure that, you know, when I did produce life, to make sure that they're stable, strong-minded adults that can live in this world when I'm no longer here, that they can carry on and provide some other things that benefit others. At the same time, I believe I was placed here to help others in many different ways. If it's just basically speaking, I'll be kind to others and do what I could to just help someone else benefit their life, always giving, not necessarily looking to come back in. At the same time, I think I was given the gift to enjoy some of the small things in life, some of the small things that the things that God has put together, some of the things that we kind of overlook. But I think he wanted me to really see his greatness and understand his greatness. And by seeing his greatness and understanding, understand his power, the power of him, what exists. And at the same time, love him for what he's done in my life and what he's done in others' lives. So that's kind of like a small snippet why I believe that I'm here and why I've been afforded to live what I classify as a damn good life, a damn good life. I've enjoyed it. I've done what I've really wanted to do. I've done some things I want to accomplish. I still have things I want to do. I've had many good highs. I have some lows I've learned from. I basically love and share love and take love in and give love back. I do that on a daily basis in different ways. So for me, yeah, that's living, bro. That's living. Mr. DeMaurice, I'm going to come to you first with this one, sir. If you had to kind of sum it up, why were you born?
When I heard the question, I thought about the Muhammad Ali quote that says, you know, you're to be a service to other people. And I do feel that way. I'm here to teach. I'm here to encourage. I'm here to do a lot of things that bring out the best of folks, whether it's me as an instructor or writing or making folks laugh, sharing music, anything that I can do to bring somebody out of a funk or out of their sadness and anything I can do to help folks. I think that's why I'm on this earth, to be of service to my fellow man and women, and to make things better and bring out the best in people. And so I have a lot of different stories of just at my job, students coming back to me. And I remember one in particular, a young man, he's African-American, and usually when you have a disability or something, you have to present the instructor with a sheet to let them know you need extra time for this or, you know, certain things that they need to help them get through the class. And he didn't give me this letter until about 2 or 3 weeks into the semester. And I noticed, you know, leadership qualities, you know, that his peers respected him, all this other stuff. And when he gave me the letter, I looked at it and I read it, and I said, I'm going to say something to you, and I don't want you to be offended by what I'm about to say. And he said, okay. And I said, don't let this letter stop you from being or stop the potential you have of being someone great or doing great work. I said, because before I got this letter, I've noticed some things about you. And so if you have never gave me this letter, I wouldn't have known anything about that. I said, but I'm going to be pushing you harder since I got this letter, because I think you can do some great things. And he kind of looked at me, and he was like, okay. And so every class, I think just about every class that I taught, this brother was sitting in the class. And I would always call on him. I would always, get on him about certain things in a positive way. And there was when he graduated, and me and my coworker, we used to have this office together. Usually, folks get a certificate. They get a frame to put their diploma in or whatever. And it's kind of like a normal frame you can hang on the wall. I remember he came in and this thing looked like a 55-inch television, the frame.
Wow.
It was the biggest frame I ever seen. And I said, what's the frame for? He said, I'm going to put my college degree in this frame, and I want you guys to see it. And I'm like, what wall are you going to hang this on? Outside? It's going to be a mural because it's a big frame. And so I remember him having a heart-to-heart conversation with me. It's like, man, I would never accomplish this if you didn't have that conversation with me, because I wouldn't take excuses for him turning in work late. Anything. I raised the bar up on him instead of saying, okay, I'm going to take a little easy on you because of your situation. I'm like, no, you're more than your situation. And I don't know if anybody else told you this, but I'm not going to treat you like, give you any special treatment. I think you could be great. And so there have been a number of stories where I've done the same thing to different students with different situations. I remember one student, she's older, and we would have conversations after class, almost every class I would have. And she was like, God put something in you to inspire folks. She said, I listen to you in class. And she's older than me. She said, I listen to you in class and all the knowledge you give out and the things that you say and how you work with the students. And she was like, and how the students talk about you, not only in class, but outside of class. And she was like, God put something in you to do what you do. So she's like, I don't know who your parents are or anything, but they raised one hell of a man. And it touched me because I wasn't expecting that. But I truly think that it's in me to try to bring out the best in people, whatever talent they have, whatever they want to do, to try to give them a word or something to be the best they can be. And it's not always easy. It's not always easy. But it seems that I figure out a way to do that and to get people on the track that they need to be to get to where they want to go.
I have to say this, man, before I come to you, Mr. Charles. You know, Mr. DeMaurice is really the reason why what we're doing with this right here, When Black Men Talk, because he basically, I know when he started the sports show, I was like, yeah, that's cool, man. I don't know how you do that. You know, we always talk about sports, yakking about sports. I'm for that. And he's always wanted me to kind of, not always, but he always kind of looked at me to kind of be doing something on the creative side. He knew I just liked, to be creative. And he came to me and he said, I want you to do a show. And my first reaction, of course, was like, at the time, which was really truthful, bro, I don't have the time. And I don't even know what it would be about. But I'm thank you. And I thank you for, thinking of me and that. But I ain't got it. I just don't have it right now. I kind of cut that cord from radio years ago. I never looked back. And that was it, bro. That's it. And he ain't pushed. He just said, I just want you to do a show. And the conversation ended like dust. Man.
I have spoken.
Man, I think back to it now. I don't even think you heard what I said. I really don't think that brother even heard what I said. I think I was just talking. He was paying me no attention. And a few days went by, and I can honestly tell you, man, I was walking around somewhere, and I just have to say, God said to me, do a show about men talking. Do a show about men. Out of nowhere, I'm walking, doing nothing, and it just came into me. Do a show about men talking. And if you go from that point, and you travel 4 to 5 years, this is what it's been. And it's amazing because if you didn't really kind of say that, this wouldn't be what it is. It just wouldn't be what it is. I'm thankful that you did. So when you're saying that, you know, you just find a way, you do, bro. I mean, I think it takes a special gift to be a teacher, period. I think we all can teach to some level of degree, but the level of patience and the level of love you must have for mankind to really want to help others and teach, that's a special gift, man. And that's not placed inside everybody. It really isn't. So I just wanted to kind of drop that in. Mr. Charles, well, why were you born, sir?
Well, I think it took me a long time to try to figure it out because a lot of stuff early on, I was like, I don't know why. And why would you make me go through all this, right? And then it dawned on me that I was born to motivate people. And not only that, I was born to also serve as a sounding board and calm people. And doing that by using my life as a vehicle and an example. Because a lot of stuff I realized that I was going through was a little bit over the top, and some people were astounded and blown away by it, and I was still standing. And this was because I had never had any counseling, or I mean, I had talked to a few people, but nothing were to the standard of what they're doing today. I mean, everything has a support group. I didn't have a support group. I had to, you know, go along, get along as I went along. But my dad had laid the foundation for that, so what was coming. But with all that being said, it finally dropped on my mind why I was doing it. And it was hard, but I just knew that I had to share strong enough. And as you said, God doesn't put anything that you can't handle. But I was strong enough to deal with this and realize that it's not always about you. It's not about you. You've dealt with what you had to deal with. Now it's time to help others. And I didn't plan it this way. I probably couldn't be the professor that DeMaurice is. He's awesome at it because we had a hell of an instructor. She shook my butt up too in college, but he went on to do great things and continued to be a beautiful example of what we should be doing in that arena. And some people had said they thought I should be a pastor, and I was like, nah. And then I said, nah, because I got too many other things in my mind. God didn't call me for that. But then they made this running joke that I tell people my famous phrase is, I meet people where they live. And what that means is, no matter what your situation, what level you are, I can meet you. If you're at the very bottom, I can meet you. Nothing surprises me. I've seen a lot of things in my life. I experienced a lot of things. And if you're on the high on the hog and you're living La Vida Loca, you got a $1.2 million home, that's cool too. Been there, done that too. I've seen it all. And none of it fades me one way or the other because I know people who've had it or don't have it. And with that being said, keeping that in mind, I meet you where you live. And I remember one time, I get off this very quick, I was out in Las Vegas, which is like my second home, where I have a lot of friends that come out, we hang out, and we're having a few cocktails, and they said something, and I mentioned something about the Lord, and the guy was like, why you got to go mess things up? And I was like, what? He like, yeah, we was having a good time, and you got to bring that God thing up. I was like, oh, so that's a problem? He was like, man, I was feeling good. I was like, okay. I said, well, one, if you learn more about me, I know God see me no matter what I'm doing, even if I'm having a double Hennessy on the rocks with Chris Ice. You hear me? So, you know, ain't no secrets here. God know my heart and he know me. So the fact that I brought him up in this atmosphere, in this environment, I'm sorry that it offended you, but I'm telling you my truth. And shortly thereafter, maybe a few months later, I saw that guy again, and we met again, same place, Las Vegas, and New York, and again. And he came back to me and started talking about the Lord, man. And our conversation just continued to get stronger every time we see each other about the Lord. Now, we still getting our drink on, but we talk more and more about the Lord. And what's amazing about it is one of my friends said, well, you mean talking to people in the casino? I was like, yeah, well, you want to call me a pastor, call me CPC, Casino Pastor Charles. There you go.
I think it's really incumbent upon us, man. If we're given a daily breath, don't take that for granted and understand why we're given that. You're given it for a reason. because some folks aren't able to give to have that anymore. And if you're still being given it to you on a daily basis, start to really kind of just ask, why? Why am I here? What could I be doing? What could I be doing better? What could I be doing to service others? Because I really believe he wants us all to service others, just not ourselves. It's not about amassing this and stockpiling that. No, I'm not saying material things don't bring on a certain feeling, but I don't believe that's the reason why we're here. I just don't. Gentlemen, we're going to take a little break. We come back, we'll get some questions from you too. Also, we're probably not going to be able to get to the happy part of the topic show I want to do this time around. But when we don't do that, I have no problem because that moves to another show, and they'll probably move on to the next show we get together. We'll talk about the pursuit of being happy. And we're going to, like Mr. Charles said earlier about what happened with his father, we're going to speak on some things we might have seen some family members or other gentlemen do, and we notice. And we're like, you know what? I'm going to do different than that. I'm not going to allow that to happen. I'm going to veer right of that and take a detour. That'll be in the next show. It's One Black Man Talk, Mr. Jim Reese, Mr. Charles, Mark Elliott. When we come back, they'll put some questions out to us. Given opportunity, you would like to cover. So I'm going to come to you first, my brother. Your question for us this time around.
Is that D. Marie?
I'll say yes, Ms. D. Marie. I'm sorry, man. I forgot to put the D in there. But yes, your question for us.
Sir. No. I couldn't hear you over the music. Go ahead. I got it. my question, I was thinking about this earlier this week, man. Cardi B has a song, and called WAP. And when I was growing up, there was a station, it was a top 40 station that I know that we all used to listen to. And the most raunchiest song that was on there was a song by Chuck Berry called My Ding-a-Ling. And I'm trying to figure out how Cardi B got away with WAP. What ass, you know what I'm talking about. So is it just me that's just kind of wondering what's going on with music and how it could be so raunchy now and little kids can listen to it and all this other stuff? Or am I just, what we said earlier, old-fashioned?
No, I don't think in that case it's old-fashioned. I think what has happened, the FCC has basically fell asleep when it comes down to what's played on the radio. And it's just they don't care anymore. You know, they're just picking up a paycheck and they're not really, you know, monitoring what's going on. And they're leaving it to these program directors just to roll. And they're up against pressure to where they're forced to be more sensationalized than anyone else because they're trying to get ratings. And the funny thing about Cardi B to me is that she started out a little bit, but every time she comes back, it's raunch takes them to another level. Because her audience keeps growing and growing and growing. And what I found to be interesting was, and I'm not knocking her hustle, whatever she does, but I remember she first came out, older sisters fell in love with her. And they would allow their kids to listen to her, their daughters, and they thought she was someone to look up to. And I've seen some older sisters now complain about that. I'm like, but wait a minute. It's the same person before you were selling to your kids. Now you want to get mad. Because to me, she's the same old raunchy hoe back then that she is now. I'm being honest with you. So I don't understand it. You know, you got either gonna roll with her being a raunchy hoe, or you're not. But to me, when it comes down to our kids shouldn't even know she exists. That's just my personal opinion. There's a place for her in modern day music. That's fine. But I know coming up, there's certain things in old fashioned way we're gonna call. There's certain artists that we didn't know exist from coming up. I mean, you spoke of Chuck Berry, that made it on because that was like a cutesy wootsy song. But I didn't know Millie Jackson, and Millie Jackson's nothing compared to Cardi B. But coming up, I didn't know Millie Jackson was out there until you got older. And Millie Jackson was always, you know, out there saying things and doing things, whatever. But now we're happy. We take pride in it, exposing our kids to people such like her. And you don't think for a second a lot of little girls want to grow up and act like her and emulate her? They don't know that she was a stripper and she did all that. They don't care. They just want to dress like her and be whatever they see, because they look at her as being a fast road to stardom and having money. So in some ways it's sad. And you might say to me, you know, Mark, you're blowing it off. But I'm not. We look at our young kids and what they're going through. You know, the same thing I said about rap music. A lot of males look at Jay-Z and the rest of these hoodlums, in my opinion, and they want to emulate them. So it's no different. It's no different. Mr. Charles, your response, sir.
Yeah, I just think that it's a different age, and when people hear this music, they think that it's something they're getting they can get away with, that they listen to it, the younger people, like they're getting away with something. And truth be told, there were some bad things out there when we were coming up, but they just didn't receive all of the attention. And like DeMarie said, yeah, you getting old, bro. You getting old. But that's why. I am too. It's okay. But I think part of it is too, is really, that's why the importance of a foundation with your children is key, right? I mean, there are some people that are they have an addictive personality, and you really got to watch them, because they might really start to look at music certain kind of way, or whatever it is, it may become too much for them. But I always believe that if you have a standard of teaching your kids certain things, they can hear something, but they're not going to get all kind of crazy with it. They go, okay, yeah, all right, I heard that, that's cool, but it's not going to overwhelm them, because they have a solid foundation and a basis to go, this is entertainment. I might say a little bit and laugh kind of cool and bobble my head, but it's entertainment. I'm not going to emulate that, and that's not my life. And I think that's what we have to get back to no matter what. So even if they hear it, they go, all right, that's enough of that foolishness. Y'all played it 79 times. I'm going to go listen to something else.
If you say so, bro. If you say so. I just think once you start to really get a diet of that, it's like anything else you eat, man. Once kids get a diet of it, they're going to want more. And you're going to have to give them something a little bit more for them to want more. And that's what happens. I mean, it's just my opinion. Your response, D. Maurice?
Well, I think there's some great points Mr. Charles made. Because I remember, you know, listening to the radio, and you can't control what they're going to play on the radio. And then having my son and daughter in the back seat, I would always, and I knew that somehow, some way they were getting to this music. You can't, you know, just protect them from everything. And I would sit there and ask them, you know, what does this mean? What does that mean? What do you think when they're saying this, what does it mean? And so we engage in conversation about it so I can guide them in the right direction. But it's harder and harder to do this with the internet and all that other stuff. And so I think it's a great point that, you know, to get to the kids. But I just remember just hearing, I didn't know what WAP was until, you know, I was talking to somebody and I heard the song and I'm like, you know, what the hell is this? And then I saw the video and I'm like, whoa, you know. And but yeah, we need to stay on top of a lot of this stuff and try to figure out where we're going and what we're doing. What messages we're sending out, because society tends to follow media. It tends to follow what they think is, or what artists think that is the proper thing to do, or they're making money from it. But we tend to kind of live with the consequences of it. So we got to really be careful and look at it and really examine it and make sure doing all to explain what they're hearing. And I think that was a great line. It's entertainment. It's not real life, it's entertainment. And so to kind of explain it to younger people so that they don't get really kind of overwhelmed with all this stuff, because it's everywhere. We can't protect them from it all, but we can help explain it to them so they get the right idea about what's entertainment, what's not real, and what is real.
Let me ask you a question. You said you heard this song on the radio, right? You know, did you see it somewhere else?
I first saw it on a video.
Did you ever hear? Did you ever hear it played on a radio station?
Yes. But they, during the day, they kind of take the last word out.
Okay.
But you know what it is. You know what it is.
Okay. Now, was this an urban radio station or was it a top 40 radio station?
Both. Because in radio stations here in Chicago, it could be a pop station or urban station. If it's hot, they're playing it. If it's hot, they're playing it. And Cardi B is one of the hottest artists out there. They're going to play her records to get the audience.
Yeah, they're kind of forced to because of the way if you don't, you will not have the ratings. I was surprised that the top 40 station played. Usually top 40 would kind of – their old model used to be it had to kind of kick butt on an urban station before they even think about playing it. So
yeah,
it must have made it obvious. It made enough noise. They wouldn't touch it without.
In Chicago, they probably jumped on it first before the urban stations had the nerve to even put it on because they'll get more complaints from the urban station than the top 40 station.
Okay. Mr. Charles, your question, sir.
Yeah, I'm going to think about this off and on, but we all have had different life experiences. If there's a time where you felt like you went through whatever you went through as a kid and you had to do grown-up things early on, my question is, do you feel like you missed some childhood, was taken away from you? And I think I talked to Dee Maurice about this. And if that's the case, then how do you deal with your inner child still, now that you're still a grown-up? And what that inner child missed, that innocence the inner child missed in your life.
That's interesting because I think you have to find a way. I don't think I was kind of forced to kind of grow up in a fast way like that. So I may not be able to totally answer that clearly, but I will say this though. I think as an adult, you have to find things inside of you that's still childish like. And I say that to say you do some things that you might have done when you were a child. And with a balance in a sense, it could be a video game. It could be some things that you just didn't get a chance to experience. It could be, shooting pool. Some things that even if you want to try to do the rollerblading or roller skating, but some things there were probably available that you didn't get a chance to really experience. And now you have that kid like in you, you find those things that kind of connect to. It can kind of bring you back a little bit for a period of time. But that would be my quick response to that. But, I think you have to find – I think at all times you have to find a way to kind of still stay a kid at heart and a little kid at mind from time to time, and just kind of find ways to kind of reconnect with your childhood, some things that you enjoyed. I mean, there's a candy that I grew up liking called Broadway Licorice. It's the red thick licorice. I'm always a big fan of licorice. But I found it. It's a company that sells it. I found it from time to time, man. I'll order a whole box of it, and it brings me back to my childhood. It just does. Small things like that, I think, that can be done that kind of help you go back. Ms. DeMaurice, your response, sir?
Yeah, definitely. Felt like I missed some things because you had to grow up real fast in my situation and handle a lot of things that, normal kids around that age shouldn't be handling. But I do find myself playing video games because I didn't have that or certain games that I couldn't get or my family couldn't afford. And now that I can't afford it, I kind of splurge on myself doing that. It's funny that you mentioned candies because I'll see the Boston Baked Beans and Mary Jane's and all of the Now Laters and all that. And I'll grab those. And probably tearing up my teeth, but yeah, I'll go back to that or grabbing potato chips. Or I remember when we were kids, we would get some money from our aunts, uncles, whatever, parents, and then we would go to the store and buy the ice cream and the potato chips and all that other stuff, and then sit up and watch The Honeymooners. I still find myself maybe about 10 or 11 o'clock at night sitting there watching some of those shows with my ice cream, with all that stuff, just sitting there enjoying the show like I was 12 years old. So yeah, it is. And I practice martial arts. And so I know the Sifu, the senior instructor, always says, you know, we're just 12 years old, living out our childhood, trying to be like Bruce Lee. That's all we're doing here. And so we're all kind of picking and choosing our ways to kind of live out that childhood that we didn't get when we were younger.
Yeah, that Bruce Lee, that's something else right there, man. Wow, you're right about that, bro. Woo! You probably had a lot of karate studios open up just based on what he did in movies, I'm here to tell you. Mr. Charles, your response to your question, sir. Good question, too.
Thank you. Yeah, it's crazy because, like I mentioned before about my life, my problem is my inner child wants to take over all the time, and I have to keep him at bay. Keep him at bay because it's like we went through hell in a handbasket, and truthfully, it's to a point where I had to think about it twice because a lot of things I don't take serious now. The things other people think are difficult, I had to really think about it because I'm like, you came through all this, but you think it's hard, man. This is nothing. But I do engage as DeMaurice mentioned in maybe some video games and, like you said, your favorite candy. And I only do it every blue moon, but I love the Nowlaters and I love the Jolly Ranchers, man. Oh my God. That is just so wonderful still to this day. And the other part of it too is as far as working out, I still shoot ball, man. I'm not running and playing basketball like that, but I always was a shooter. Even when we were in college, I had a nice little jumper. And to this day, I'm like, well, you can't shoot because you're older. So once I got clear from my surgeries, so I'm out there now. Anybody want to play any horse? Anyway, I'm just playing. Play 3-point horse. Anyway, but yeah, but it's so invigorating, man, because you're out there by yourself and it's usually beautiful weather and you get a sweat in and it's nothing like it. And it takes you back to a time where things were simple and good. And I wish a lot of people had that in their lives because I don't think a lot of us have that ability to go and just do something that relieves everything that's on your brain and allows you for a few minutes to just focus on you and just enjoy life as we know it.
Gentlemen, quick question before we kind of get out of it. We're going to wrap it up in a little bit. Before we do that, we'll go light too. But when you were younger, let's say your early 20s, what would be some of the things, name two or three things that if you had the money, you just had to spend it all. If you had the cash, you know, your early 20s are 19, 18, 19, 21, 22. If you had the money, it would just roll out of your hand and you had to buy it, Mr. Charles.
Probably a nice little car. I wasn't big on cars then because I drove kind of hoopties for a long time. But cars, travel, man. I'd have been everywhere. Yeah, I saw the kids on spring break. I never got to go to spring break in Florida. Damn it, I would have been there. I'd have been in Vegas early. I'd have been living La Vida Loca. Yeah, I travel would have been mine, man, pretty much. I mean, the other stuff, I mean, the cars and the clothes, I ain't really worried about that, but I wanted to go meet some people. I'll carry me to the Dominican Republic at 22 years old. Let me raise some hell, bro.
Mr. DeMaurice, if you had the cash back then, what was something that you just wanted, you had to spend it on, bro? There was only a couple of things that you just had to spend it on.
I would have to agree with traveling because I never forget the first time I went to North Carolina on a Greyhound bus by myself. Because usually when you travel with your family or there was a family member there, somebody there you travel with. But it felt just so freeing going somewhere by yourself and meeting new people and experiencing new things. And it was just freeing. And I've been able after that to like take trips, going to Germany by myself, you know, traveling different places by myself. And I just love that feeling just to pick up, go and just travel and then have new experiences traveling. So if I was in my 20s, it would definitely be traveling, but out of the country, somewhere around the world where I didn't know anybody, I didn't know the language, but to just grab some more experiences in life.
I'm going to tell you, man. I mean, for me, it was definitely clothes, electronics, man. I mean, I enjoyed the travel, but I don't know what it was about electronics back then, man. It was just something about electronics and clothes. There was a tight 1A and tight B, but most of the time clothes kind of went out. But I got off clothes quite a bit because what I found with clothes is that you can start to spend a lot of money and they're not really worth it. But electronics, to an extent, still kind of plays a role, but things that would definitely kind of take money out of my hand. Gentlemen, as we, with the time we have left, we'll go light. And when we go light, you know, we talk about what's happening kind of in the sports world. It kind of set things up with tomorrow night when we do the sports show, the Goon Squad. But the question that's got to be had, man, or maybe should be asked is, how about them Cowboys?
I'm not talking about them no more. I can't talk about them no more. I can't talk about the Giants no more. I'm not talking about the Bears no more. All these bottom feeder teams, I'm done with. I'm really done with. I can't do it.
Mr. Jones?
I want to thank the Dallas Cowboys and Jerry Jones for something. I've been watching them for years as a fan, and the one thing about Dallas back in the day is you knew they would fight, and they would fight, and they would fight to the end. This team's not a fighter. This is the NFL version of the Los Angeles Clippers, and I want to thank them for showing me that they don't want to fight, and they, despite all of the hype, they quit. They're not living up to their potential. So when they get blown out by 20, 35, 40 points, I'm good with that. And that's going to be my expectations. Still a team I root for, but I'm done. I'm good. My expectations are what they are. So I'll still watch them. Y'all can still razz me about them losing. I'm good with that. But at the same time, I really don't give a damn no more because they're not the team. They don't represent the franchise that I know and I grew up with. It's okay.
Here's the thing that kind of just catches me, and I'm not sure even who to blame for this, but how do you show up to games and get beat down by 30 or 40 points, and then decide, guess what, we just going to go on a run, just a run, when they're basically tired and don't care no more, we can go back and run and try to, what happens where you just don't come into the game and just play well? And to me, that's the puzzling thing about them, because I know people are going to say, well, their defense not that good. But, you know, at least your offense should kind of carry you till your defense gets better. And they scored. I mean, they was on a run in the fourth quarter, just going up and down the field. And they're excited, act like they're winning the game. And I'm looking at them and saying to myself, do you realize you're playing the Cleveland Browns at home? And you're fighting to get back in the game against Cleveland Browns. And all the talent, I mean, CeeDee Lamb and all that you have, it's like, and you hit a point there, Mr. Joyce, about fight, because I'm telling you, the receiver, I can't think of his name, but Oakland had him and let him go. I can't think of his name right now. That brother has no fight in him. Every time he catches the ball, he got to go to the sideline. Every time he catches the ball, he's tapping his helmet to go out to the sideline. Every time he throws a pass, he goes to the sideline. What is that about? I'm not trying to make fun of them, but it's like I've never – this year, that team is way too talented to be, and they should really be 0-4. They should be 0-4 if the Atlanta Falcons had any idea how to basically handle an onside kick. But it's just – I know you look at them and go, wow. I'm watching the Chargers with a rookie quarterback play with more fight, more balance, and more attack than the Cowboys, and it makes no sense. And that cat for the Chargers, he ain't making none of the money. None of the money that half the Cowboys are making. I'm Jerry Jones, and he's back on the air talking. He should be pissed. Because if this is what you're paying your money for, you put a good show on the fourth quarter. I'll give you credit for that. But outside of that, man, I don't know what the hell is going on with them. Gentlemen, we'll get together again next week, and we'll do this, of course, tomorrow night. We'll get together and do the sports. I'm just wondering how the picks look this week, man, because somebody's been kind of quiet. So I'm just kind of trying to figure out what's going on with the picks.
You got to wait until tomorrow. How about that?
Yeah, that's always the case. Y'all have a good night, gentlemen.
Oh,